So we're very happy that you as well. Brian is going to talk for about 15 minutes about his book, and then we'll have a panel discussion with Stephen Hansen and Oye Oleker, who are sitting backwards from how they're listed on my sheet here. Oye is a senior advisor and director of the Russia and Eurasia program here at CSIS, and Stephen Hansen is the vice provost for international affairs and director of the Wendy and Emery Reeves Center for International Studies and the Letty Pate Evans Professor in the Department of Government at the College of William and Mary. And once they have given some remarks about the presentation and the book, we'll open it up for discussion. Please silence your cell phones and other noise-making devices. And without further ado, let me turn it over to Brian Taylor.
Thanks, Jeff, and thanks everyone for coming. Thanks to Oye and Steve for agreeing to comment. Sorry? Okay. That was all just a bunch of thank yous, so I'll do them again. thanks to Jeff for the intro. Thanks to Oye and Steve for commenting and for CSIS for organizing this. It's really nice also to have the partnership between CSIS and Maxwell and to be able to do this talk in that context. So what's this book about? The basic idea of the union called working on this book, and the problem I ran into is thinking about anatomy and physiology, if I was going to use this biological analogy, was I really need to understand the brain, the nervous system, to make sense of what the system as a whole is doing. So that led me to this idea of trying to dissect as much as one can the mentality behind Vladimir Putin and the team around him. So the effort is to provide a more kind of conceptual, as opposed to a biographical way of thinking about what Putin is up to, basically, what motivates him and his team. So there are three core arguments in the book, basically. The first one is Putin matters, and you're like, oh, great, I'm glad I came to this. I didn't know that before I walked into the room. But I think it's important to say that because there are lots of approaches in the social sciences and beyond the social sciences to thinking about political systems, including Russia, that point to things that have nothing to do with personality, right? So if we think about some common explanations about Russian politics, things to do with history, geography, culture, oil, communist legacies, all things that have really nothing to do with Vladimir Putin as a personality. But given that we have a personalistic political system in Russia under Putin, I think it's important to try and get at what's going on inside his thinking and the thinking of the people around him. So what matters about Putin is the claim in the book is what I call the code of Putinism. And this idea of a code, this term of a code, it doesn't come from Dan Brown and the Da Vinci Code. It actually comes from a famous old book from Soviet studies called The Operational Code of Bolshevism. Old timers in the audience might remember that book from the 1950s. But the idea is that there's a complex set of things that are driving decision making. So I'm trying to steer between what I see as two kind of extremes out there that one sometimes encounters when talking about Putin. One is that he's a technocrat, a rational pragmatist. On the other hand, we sometimes hear, especially since 2014, that he's a strident Russian nationalist. And I think both of those views are wrong. I think there's a more complex set of motivations going on, and that's what I try and unpack in the book. And I'll come back to this in a second. So the third core argument is that the code has certain effects on what's going on in Russian politics. So this is getting into the anatomy and physiology. It affects the nature of the political system, the nature of the economic system, how the country is governed, and the country's foreign policy. So in terms of domestic effects, I think the code of Putinism, the style of rule that follows from that, leads to a Russia that's underperforming at home. And I mean that in terms of governance and in terms of economic performance. And in terms of international policy, I think it leads to a foreign policy that I would consider overambitious given Russia's material endowment, and therefore leading to certain foreign policy consequences, seeking status beyond its resources. Okay, so what's the code? And here I take as my starting point an insight from the German sociologist Max Weber about what are the sources of human conduct. And he boils them down to basically four different issues. The first is what he calls instrumental rationality. So that's more or less understandable, sort of rationally pursuing your goals. He has a second one that he calls value rationality, which we can think of as ideas or values. A third that he calls affect, which basically means emotions, and a fourth which he calls habit or tradition. So most social scientists mainly spend their time talking about the first of these issues, sort of instrumental rational reasons for political actors to do certain things. Some political scientists talk about ideas also and the influence of ideas. Very few talk about emotions and habits because it's hard to talk about these things. Steve Hacks, what Weber is doing with this description of the motives for human action. So the tricky part, of course, is the hubris of saying, so this is the second act of hubris, right, after following Merle Fain's said. The second is thinking I can sort of say what the emotions and habits and ideas are that lie behind Putin and the people around him. So how do I do this? And I don't want to get into methods too much here, but the short and done, and then you look at what people who study the system like you are also saying about what they're doing, and talk to lots of smart people in Moscow and St. Petersburg and other places in Russia about what the guy's up to, and use that to try and distill it to a few basic things. So I come up with a list of 12. I'm not going to talk about all of them here, and I'm only really going to mention them in passing just to give you a sense of where the argument goes. So first of all, in terms of ideas, I think Vladimir Putin is a statist. I think he believes that Russia has to be a great power to be successful, both at home and abroad. And this one is probably contested, but I would say he's fundamentally anti-American in his belief system. It's certainly very suspicious, at least, of the United States. The second category I talk about is habits. I consider things like control, the importance of loyalty in personnel decisions and in other decisions, the importance of unity, which you might also refer to as being anti-pluralist in terms of the political system, I think are core habits that he learned earlier in his career and that affect the way he makes decisions today, and also many of the people around him who have similar backgrounds. And then finally, in terms of emotions, I think respect is a really important emotion to him. I think that manifests itself often in terms of resentment at how he feels that Russia has been mistreated and overlooked and ignored, and also a sense of vulnerability, both about Russia's status in the world and about the stability of the political system internally and the possible consequences of problems with that. So, as I have to unpack all of these, but I try and bring up in the book, which is, although I talk about these things as discrete elements, I actually think they're kind of interconnected, right? So when Soldatov is talking about the state of U.S.-Russian relations and how the Russian leadership feels, he says it's an emotional story of Russia not being treated like a superpower, and to many of them, it's a personal story. So what's important about this quote? It's about emotions, right? It's about status, but it's also ideas about Russia's proper place in the world. And so ideas and emotions come together here to affect Russian foreign relations with the United States. All right, in the rest of my time, I want to briefly give you a sense of just how the book is laid out without going into too much detail about any of the specific chapters. And then after Steve and Olya respond, we can maybe get into some more detailed discussion. But the first two chapters after I lay out the code talks about the political system, and I divide it into two different parts, the formal institutional side of the story and then the informal side of the story, because both are very important for understanding Russian politics. So in terms of the formal political system, I refer to it as a system of leashes and clubs. And the leash analogy came from a discussion with the Russian journalist and analyst Masha Lipman, who said, the Kremlin has a series of leashes, some long, some short, depending on the circumstances. And I thought that was a really good insight. And the notion of a club actually comes from a quote from Vladimir Putin fairly early on in his tenure as president, in which he said, the state has a club. It hasn't had to use it yet. But when it does need to use it, it'll use it without mercy. So I like this idea of both sort of soft means of control and then harder means of control as necessary. So we can think of this also as the leash as being a menu of manipulation that you can manipulate political parties or NGOs or the parliament. And then if necessary, you can go to a menu of repression. Combining these two, I think we've moved under Putin from a system that's super presidential by constitutional design to one that I call hyper presidential, where he's weakened both the formal institutions of power, the judiciary, the parliament, the regions, and also non-state actors such as parties, NGOs, and the media. The second chapter about the political system is called Clans and Networks, because one of the most important questions in Russian politics is, whose person is this? Who are they connected to? And these are connections that cross institutional lines from public to private, different bureaucracies. And the Russian political system, as many analysts have noted, has this sort of dual nature with the formal constitutional side and then the super important but kind of in the background informal side. And the picture is one set of analysis by a couple of Russian sociologists from 2011 to try and map the networks around Putin. And I'm not going to go into the details of the picture, it's just illustrative. But I think one of the things that's worth noting about it is that this was done in 2011, in which Vladimir Putin was the prime minister of the country, not the president of the country. And you have to strain your eyes really hard to find Dmitry Medvedev on there. He's like down over here, right? That's Medvedev in terms of the size and centrality of his network compared to Putin's network. So this matters a lot. The next two chapters are about economics and governance in turn. And the chapter on economics is called Lawyer, Guns, and Oil. Lawyers, Guns, and Oil, mainly because I wanted to mention a Warren Zevon song in my book somewhere. So I adapted his notion of lawyers, guns, and money from his famous song about that. And the photos here show us one of the chief lawyers in Russia, the head of the investigative committee, one of the chief wielders of guns, the head of the FSB, the Federal Security Service, and then the head of the Rosneft oil company. And the thing to know about all of these people is they all have very long-standing ties to Putin. They went to law school with him, or they worked in the KGB with him, or they worked in the St. Petersburg mayor's office with him. So he's put his people through various important positions, not only in the state, but also in the economy. So the lawyers and guns in the story are kind of analogous to the leashes and clubs. And the court system and law enforcement are used to control non-state business. And then state business is also expanded in terms of its percentage of the economy under Putin by bringing in key sectors of the economy and putting them in the hands of loyalists to Putin. The next chapter is on governance, and it's called How Russia is Misruled. So I'm referring back to the Feinsod book, How Russia is Ruled. And what I try and do in this chapter is look at some of the consequences of the way the system is governed for its performance in doing things like delivering services to citizens and providing effective oversight, rule of law, control of corruption, those sorts of things. So I tell some vignettes about different areas like healthcare and roads and law enforcement and the Sochi Olympics. And then I also look at some cross-national data that tries to analyze the quality of governance in different countries. And I try to compare Russia to countries that seem natural comparisons, either former Soviet states or countries at similar levels of income or countries it considers its peers like the BRICS countries of Brazil, India, China, and South Africa. And what these cross-national data show, I try to demonstrate, is that Russia underperforms in terms of the quality of its governance given how it does relative to its peers. The final two chapters are about foreign policy and then the future. So the foreign policy chapter is called Punching Above Its Weight. It's something that's frequently said about Putin's foreign policy. I actually heard this from Dmitry Trainin, who's a very well-known Russian political analyst at the Carnegie Moscow Center. And one of the reasons that people see Russia as punching above its weight, it goes back to something that Putin famously said in 2005, that the collapse of the Soviet Union was one of the greatest geopolitical catastrophes of the 20th century. And from his point of view, and especially if we pick up on the word geopolitical, he's right. Earlier in the 20th century, Russia was as much as 10% of the world economy and as much as 8% of world population if we look at the Soviet Union as a whole. Now, if we look at post-Soviet Russia, it's less than 2% of the world economy and less than 2% of world population. But here we all sit in a room talking about Vladimir Putin, and Forbes magazine says he's the most powerful man in the world. So Russia, in that sense, is punching above its weight, in my view. This is also, I claim, a consequence of the code. And then the last chapter is called Putinism Forever. There's a question mark there, as you can see. And I don't predict when he will leave the stage, how he will leave the stage, what will follow him. But what I try and do in the conclusion is talk about some of the accumulated problems over the last 18 years in terms of economic performance and stagnation, in terms of the quality of governance, in terms of corruption, in terms of the very personalized political system with very weak formal institutions, and discuss the idea that in a certain sense, I think Putin has led Russia into a dead end, and that they're gonna have to come back out of that dead end and move forward after he leaves the scene. Again, I'm not predicting when that will happen or how that will happen. I'm certainly happy to talk about that. But the overall conclusion of the book is that Putinism as a system of rule, although it's elevated Russia's status in the world, has led to certain problems internally that are going to be there for whoever his successor is. Thank you.
Sticking to the time. Now pass the mic, the gavel, whatever, to Olya.
So thank you. Thanks to Brian for having written this book and giving us an opportunity to have this conversation. I was actually on several airplanes yesterday. One of the airplanes I was on yesterday was flying from Riga, Latvia to Frankfurt, Germany. And I was sitting in an aisle seat, and I had this book in my lap because I had this event today. And the gentleman across the aisle from me said, "May I take a picture of your book? This looks like exactly what I've been looking for." So I hold it up for him, and he takes a picture, and I say, "Are you interested in Russia? Do you study politics?" And he says, no, "I'm Italian, and I think Putin, he has the answer. So I've been looking for a book that explains this and explains how this works, because I think this is the answer for all of us." And I said, "Okay, I'm not sure if you'll like what this book says, but I suggest that you do read it. I recommend that you pick it up." And I think while he's looking for an instruction manual or something that can be applied elsewhere, I think that if this gentleman does read the book, and I hope he does, he'll find that it's more about describing how the ways that people think about things will affect their behavior, and specifically how that creates a system like that which we have in Russia, which perhaps will make him rethink whether this is what we all need, but perhaps not. This concept of Putinism, I was struck early on, Brian likens it more to Thatcherism or Reaganism than to Marxism and Leninism, which I initially, in saying that, thought, okay, so he means it's more about style and ideology than it is about, well, ways of ruling or governing, right, yeah. Which is a differentiation he makes. Although, of course, there's going to be overlaps. To me, the ruling and the governing part of it is at least partly about institutions, new ways of doing things, whereas the ideology and the style is about trying to accomplish certain goals using the systems that are in place. But as I read the book, it's really, if I may use the word, which has become a dirty one here, it's sort of hybrid, right? There's a lot of style here, but there's a certain amount of institutions, right? The sistema of clans and networks is an institution. It is a way of governing Russia. And I think that's an important thing to kind of pick out and identify in and of itself. Asking what the combination is and how it works, I think is really is really important and really worth delving into. And I think Brian's book does a really good job of highlighting these questions. Now, as I was reading it, I kept asking myself, and I think we all do, and this is, you know, this is why we're here. This is the premise of the book, right? How much of this is Putin and how much of it is Russia? And Brian's argument is that it's Putin, right? It's right there in the title. And this is kind of where I may part ways with him. I struggle with this. I struggle with defining what's Putin and what's Russia. But as I go through the code, I keep saying, yeah, that's Putin, but it's also Russia, or at least part of Russia. You know, the kind of trying to identify the specifically Putin-y aspects of the code, I have answers to those questions, but they're sort of untested. There are things, I look at the control and hypermasculinity and I say, yeah, that seems Putin to me, although they're also present in other parts of Russian society and culture. And the anti-Westernism and the great power stuff, well, that's everywhere, so that's less Putin. And kind of, I think, and I certainly haven't had time to do this, but if one is to go further with this, a clear methodology that does try to ascribe specific things to a specific individual, the specific ruler, as opposed to the system, it's hard to do, but it's kind of worth doing for the purposes of unpacking it. I also think wherever you come down to Putin's role in this code, it does describe Russia really well. And I think this book is fantastic for people who are trying to understand Russia and how it works, because it describes Russia really well. I think it's kind of the sistema overlaid with the leashes and the clubs. I think that's how it, that's it. That's, you've got it. That explains why there are certain freedoms, but they're constrained. It explains why and how you have distortions of policy preferences, particularly in economics and in domestic politics. And it explains why sometimes things work just fine. So I think that's fantastic. I also think, kind of to bring in another book by another colleague of ours who's been writing about these things, Brian talks about Putinomics. Chris Miller has a book called Putinomics. They say some of the same things a little bit differently, I would say, right? They're in line with each other. I would say Chris's take on the economic system in Russia is very much in line with Brian's code of Putinism, in that Chris sees economics and economic policy as being in service to the state, right? So the control and the populism are important, and they're more important than making money, but it's nice to make money if you can. And I think this this really fits in with this question of how the economic deals tie in to the clubs and the leashes and the clans and the networks. I do, however, think that foreign policy is the least well explained by the code. Right, when you're talking about economic policy, when you're talking about domestic politics, it's all about the networks, the clans, the leashes, and the clubs. When you're talking about foreign policy, it's about a little bit of overreach, but you're coming back to the aspects of the code that aren't the loyalty and the control and the things that drive the clubs and the leashes and the clans and the networks. They're about the great power resentments, the feelings of vulnerability, and liberal and anti-Americanism, anti-liberalism and anti-Americanism. I think these are a bit overdetermined. To be completely honest, I think that neorealist political science theory does a pretty good job of explaining how Russia behaves in the world. I'm not convinced that Russia's overreaching exactly. The fact, punching above its weight, well, if nice work if you can get it, right? If you can get the effects you want at relatively little cost, why wouldn't you? I actually think that here too, there's a logic to Russia's actions. So I think that this would be an interesting thing to kind of come back to and unpack a little bit. Finally, I think, you know, kind of the big question this book leaves us with, you know, if you accept that this describes Russia, if you accept that this describes how the Russian leadership thinks, even if you quibble with bits and pieces of it, as I do, if you, you know, believe that, yeah, this is pretty much right. So what does that mean? And you talk about the future a little bit, but what does it mean for those who might want to change Russia from within, or from those who have to deal with Russia, whether or not it changes from without? And I suspect I'm probably out of time, so I'm not going to get to go into this, but I think this would be a really interesting thing to hear Brian's opinions of, at least.
Okay, great. That'll give us a lot to discuss. So, Steve?
Thank you so much for inviting me. Let me start by just saying, if you haven't bought this book yet, you definitely need to buy the book. I really do feel this is a breakthrough in studying contemporary Russia. And the reason, in a nutshell, is that we have, for the first time, I think, a coherent description of Putinism that doesn't make the mistake of assuming this is an ideology. That is a full-fledged doctrine of a Marxist-Leninist type. Isms, you know, that has that sort of ring to it. We tend to think it must be something really codified. You could teach it in, you know, primary school classes. Putinism, from this account, couldn't be taught in quite that way. It's not that organized. And yet there's a coherence to it. The coherence comes, as Brian said, from these other Weberian categories of human behavior. It comes from coherent emotions like resentment. It comes from coherent habits. Some of them are KGB habits of control, loyalty, discipline. And an idea, if not an ideology, that loyalty to the state, in Russian государственность, is a key duty of people in Russia, which they abandoned somehow in the Gorbachev and Yeltsin eras, and which Putin is able to articulate as a key reason for his success, that he restored the Russian state. I think Brian is absolutely right that understanding the coherence of the Putinism without thinking of it as an ideology allows us to sort of get out of two traps. One is assuming an overarching coherence to Putin's strategies domestically and internationally, when there may be a lot less coherence underneath the surface than it sometimes appears, without going the other direction and saying this is just a rational actor who's tacking back and forth to liberalism, to conservatism, to orthodoxy, whatever works, without having any core beliefs of his own. I think Brian demonstrates that there really are some core beliefs here, that they're sincerely held. And I actually will disagree a little with Olya on this question of foreign policy. I think there are ways in which the foreign policy analysis does flow from that, although I'll add a quibble at the end. Why don't we typically approach foreign leaders in general, not just Putin, from the perspective of a kind of empathy, in a way, for the worldview that they adopt? I would say that because of the history of social science, the history of our punditry, it tends to be associated with a sort of soft, muddle-headed way of thinking, or at worst, a sort of apology for the individual. If you say, I think Putin actually believes in something, you know, sounds like a slippery slope to saying, and therefore it was okay that he annexed Crimea, or, you know, I admire him, or maybe this Italian gentleman, you know, might be the next step. And I think Brian is very careful to say, understanding the motivations of Putin and those around him, and those Russians who support him, is not by any means the same thing as legitimizing or approving, or let alone following that kind of conduct. And I think that is crucial to emphasize because in our, as I say, our foreign policy punditry community and in social science circles, that same kind of fear of being seen as soft-headed, not quite scientific enough, of sort of overemphasizing ideas is a real problem if, as Brian suggests, understanding those ideas, those habits, those emotions is actually critical to grasping a pretty important actor in foreign policy, in this case, Russia. He also points to, in the first chapter, another trap, in addition to sort of just thinking of Putin as a rational actor with no motivations whatsoever, other than power or money. The other trap is to think of Putin as just Russian. And here, too, there's a slight difference of opinion potentially on the panel. Brian thinks that we have to understand Putin as a specific kind of Russian. It is a Russian phenomenon. He says that, too. But, you know, Putin is not the ordinary Russian. And in fact, we often make a mistake, it seems to me, in analyzing Russia today, in assuming that a country of 140 plus million people, you know, with extremely diverse ethnicities, backgrounds, we could add to that, of course, the fact that most of the people in Russia are not following politics all that carefully, as is in the case of every country, that somehow there's a sort of single-mindedness about any issue, whether it would be domestic politics or foreign policy. This is a very complex beast. Understanding Russia means understanding a highly educated, sophisticated population that travels around the world. To reduce it all to a single individual, or to reduce the individual to the culture in a funny kind of way, disables our ability to break apart our analysis of the Putin regime and our analysis of Russia as a society. And that, too, has foreign policy consequences, because to the extent that we in the United States lump together all Russians with Putin and vice versa, we lose leverage sometimes and say things and do things that actually unite Russian people with the regime rather than splitting them apart. So I like very much the idea that, you know, looking at Putinism as a code is different from sort of of reducing things to thousands of years of Russian quote-unquote culture, a viewpoint that he and I would both reject. I'll just add quickly that it wasn't that long ago that everyone was lambasting Sovietology for our failure to predict that Russian society could produce radical change in a short period of time. Everyone was saying, oh, the Sovietologists, they assume Russia never changes. They missed Gorbachev, they missed Yeltsin. For 15 years, we had radical liberalizing reforms, for better or for worse. And so it would be a shame, indeed, to go back to the sort of static analysis of eternal Russia that led us down in that crucial period in the 80s and 90s. Things can change again, and they can change pretty rapidly. Let me add three quibbles. I think I have 2 minutes for three quibbles.
Sure.
Maybe two and a half.
No, cut them off.
No quibbles.
Here's the quibbles. So the first one is, I think that actually Brian may underestimate just a little bit how exportable the code of Putinism is. And actually, your anecdote tells that story very, very clearly. Brian is at pains to say it's not an ideology like Marxism-Leninism, thus this is not the Cold War again. That's, you know, a contest of two ideological worldviews. Clearly, that's correct. Having said that, I think there's more there that can be exported, ideationally, we should say, and even emotionally than maybe at first in the introduction talk about. And I think the reason for that is that these particular emotions, these particular habits, and these particular ideas, that is statism, loyalty, order and control, and resentment, are pretty common in the liberalized 21st century global order. They turn out to resonate in this country too, I might add, and in ways which matter a lot for understanding politics in a number of regimes. If there is a commonality here, I think it's post-imperial as opposed to just post-Soviet. If you look at Erdogan in Turkey, and you mentioned this in the introduction, that there are many people who have made the parallels between Erdogan's leadership and Putin's leadership, or if you look at Orban in Hungary, or if you look at the current Italian government, or any number of others, they have in common a hankering for a certain kind of imperial past, at least one in which the state has a primacy of place, in which loyalty to the state matters, in which a sort of uniformity of popular views of the state should be enforced. And I think many of those things connect to the resentments that you see in the Putin case, but you see in these others too. A second quick quibble has to do with periodization. Sorry for the academic language here. Brian really sees Putinism as a code emerging and consolidating around 2003, 2004 with the arrest of Khodorkovsky, the Beslan terrorist incident, the elimination of gubernatorial elections, the Orange Revolution, the Rose Revolution. And that makes a lot of sense. But I think there's a further breakpoint in 2011, 2012 that I would mark as just as significant. And what I would, this of course was during the election cycle in which Medvedev gave way back to Putin, in which it was sort of announced to everybody in Russia, this had been agreed to long ago, it was kind of a charade, this made a lot of people angry, and people turned out on the streets in the hundreds of thousands in major Russian cities, chanting things like Russia без Путина, right, Russia without Putin. I think that that's not just episodic, and the Medvedev interregnum matters quite a lot, because what happened there, from my point of view, is that the code shifted in one critical respect from embracing election results as a part of legitimacy, as something you could point to and say Russia's a democracy, kind of like Western democracies, to being not that significant to the legitimation strategy, to loyalty to the state being more about loyalty to Putin and Putin loyalists, rather than loyalty to a party or a regime which somehow has a plebiscitarian component, that is, chosen by the people. I think Putin decided after the events of 2011, 2012, that it was just too dangerous for the other things he cared about, especially power and order, to allow this kind of electoral legitimacy to emerge. And that, finally, is my third quibble, which is, I think on the foreign policy side, it matters a little bit after 2011, 2012 that that kind of notion of Western legitimation is less important, specifically when you look at the difference between things like recognizing the quote-unquote independent sovereign status of South Ossetia and Abkhazia, that is mirroring what the Putin people saw as our decisions in Kosovo, to outright annexation of a neighboring country's territory, and done, yes, episodically and only at first, with phraseology like Novorossiya, hearkening back to Catherine the Great, hearkening back to truly imperial definitions of Russian statehood. Those imperial tropes have been emphasized, I think, a lot more after 2011, 2012 than before, and that maybe does account for some of the, frankly, imperial overstretch. If you think, as I do and Brian does, that the military and economic capacity don't quite justify the degree of intervention in Syria and Ukraine at the same time, for that matter, in Western elections, and that there could be blowback from that down the road, I think one of the motivations is that they moved out of a notion of thinking themselves as a just as good Western power that was just not getting respect to an imperial power that had to be restored.
Okay, good. We are in ahead of schedule. Thank you all for overfulfilling the plan.
Well, I guess I have another plan.
I'm going to kick it back to Brian to respond to some of the remarks and criticisms that we've heard, and then we'll open it up to a wider discussion.
I'm trying to decide if I actually want to respond or if I should just turn it open, because, I mean, Steve and Ilya were both very nice. But let me just hit a few points that we'll probably come back to. How much is it Putin versus how much of it is Russia, I think, is a critical point. And there is a bit of a discussion about this in the book, because actually one of the first times I presented the manuscript in a draft workshop, that was one of the first objections. This sounds like Russia to me. This isn't just about Putin. But I firmly believe, and Steve articulated this well, that trying to reduce Russian society to one single cultural viewpoint that overlaps entirely with the viewpoint of Putin and his team, I think, is a mistake. I think Russia is much more variegated than that, and I think we can't really isolate one specific culture that dominates all the others. So I think there are elements that rhyme, right, more largely with the society, and then there are elements that are more discordant. So obviously Putinism is not completely divorced from Russian reality. He did not parachute in from outer space or anything like that, but I still hew to the importance of the personality, the individual, and the team in shaping where Russia has gone. And the claim would be, in a counterfactual sense, right, if we imagine a different history, a different leader, that things wouldn't have gone in the same direction, and that we can attribute the specific direction to Putin and the people around him in this code or mentality that I talk about. I think I just want to raise one other issue that Steve talked about before we open it up, and this is the issue of periodicization, right? Is this multiple periods? Is this one coherent period? And given that I trace a lot of this to a certain set of ideas, habits, and emotions that are fairly deeply rooted, I see a pretty consistent trajectory. And I see this particularly after the 2003-2004 breakpoint that I mentioned. At this point, Putin ditches several people from the Yeltsin administration who had a great influence and really, I think, starts relying more on his gut. For a couple of years, he was feeling his way and taking advice from different people, and then he decided he knew what to do. There's even this anecdote, I don't know if it's true, but the story goes that Igor Sechin, who's now head of Rosneft and has been closely associated with Putin for a long time, worked in the Kremlin in this time period. When the previous prime minister, a guy named Kasyanov, left, that he basically showed him the door and said, thank you for showing us how to run the country. We've got it now, we'll do it on our own. And so that's when I feel like we really see Putinism sort of coming into its own. Now, is 2011, 2012 a significant break point? It's certainly a change point, right? I wouldn't say it's wholly, completely consistent across the period from 2004 to 2018. I think the Medvedev period was different. Even though Putin was the most important actor in the system, Medvedev put his own stamp on it. But I see what happened after 2011, 2012, highlighting features that were already there quite strongly in Putin's second term from 2005 to 2008. The anti-Americanism becomes more pronounced. The notion of Russia as a great power becomes more pronounced. The resentment becomes more pronounced. The order and control becomes more pronounced. So I think that returns after the Medvedev period rather than being a super sharp break. But I understand Steve's point about how there maybe is a bigger discontinuity there than I argue in the book.
If I could just leap in on that really quickly before I turn it over. I mean, we've been having this discussion about how well the model applies to domestic politics versus foreign policy, and I think the break at 2011-2012 is actually interesting because it does represent a fissure in terms of continuity of foreign policy in a lot of ways, the way Steve described, but in terms of the domestic governance model, not so much. And so, you know, I think if there's a sense in which, you know, this is specifically Putinist and this depends on things that Putin himself is doing that are independent from or separate from how other actors in the Russian political system are operating, the election in 2012 and the shift towards this much more assertive anti-American approach to foreign policy is really where you see that effect. And on some of the codes of domestic behavior, those maybe are baked into the system from the beginning a little bit more. And incidentally, you also see them in a lot of other post-Soviet countries. So there's maybe a sense in which it's not only a code of Putinism, but it's kind of a code of post-Sovietism.
So can I jump in here? Builds on things Steve said. I don't know that it's just post-Soviet. I think, you know...
Well, like you say, it's exportable.
Well, no, I mean, this is how to build autocracy, right? But it's not that this is a revolutionary way to build autocracy. Mm. This is how people have built autocracy for many years in many places. And this isn't just how to build autocracy, it's how to build a lasting autocracy where people don't mind the autocracy so much, where the leashes are long enough for enough people that you can continue to, you can have a pretty good life. A journalist told me an anecdote in Moscow that he had veered off after one of the protests to sit down in a coffee shop. And, you know, as the crowds were chanting, Russia will be free, there were a group of people drinking sparkling wine next to him, just to each other saying, what are they on about? Russia is free. Mm-hmm. But again, I don't think this is just post-Soviet. I think we study the post-Soviet space, so we see the similarities there. But Middle East, Latin America, this is in lots of places.
We should open this up, but in some ways, yes, and in some ways, no. I mean, there is a certain institutional legacy in terms of the way that the state relates to property and the access to resources is distributed that's very specific to the former Soviet Union. And there are other ways in terms of mechanisms of control and other things that, yeah, you definitely see in lots of other contexts. But we should not be just talking amongst ourselves. Let's go ahead. So here. And please wait for the microphone. And when you get the microphone, please identify yourself, state your affiliation, and ask a question.
Thank you very much. My name is Paolo von Schirach. I'm the president of the Global Policy Institute here in Washington, D.C. Many thanks to the author for the book and for running by us all the highlights, and thanks for the comments. Just focusing on your last comments about the, basically, if I understood correctly, about the questionable sustainability of Putinism because of the, let's say, contradictions or extremes that characterize his regime based on the code and what have you. I don't know if you agree with this consideration that the main characteristic of the regime as is complete lack of accountability. In other words, we would like to think that Western democracies are superior because we have a system that enforces or obliges rulers to be accountable, to have transparency, and therefore that creates a dialogue between the governed and the governors, which is completely lacking in Putin's Russia. Of course, it was lacking in the Soviet Union, and many would argue that's what led to its demise, because there was no possibility for self-improvement. In other words, would you agree that what Putin has done essentially has been to institutionalize essentially criminal behavior? In other words, this is not just a way of governing. This is a way of pillaging the country and distributing the spoils to a number of selected faithful followers who administer to their own benefit, quite frankly, rather than a national benefit, state resources, which is mostly, you know, fossil fuels, and this is done in a obviously completely opaque fashion, and that has prevented Russia to make, as you pointed out, investments and other, you know, in a productive fashion, because there is no concern about that. The concern is for this group of oligarchs led by Mr. Putin to stay in power. And that's going to be, in my view, and I don't know if you agree, probably the seeds of the downfall of a regime that is based primarily on the autocratic control of a few resources that, of course, Russia demonstrably has. Do you see that as the end game or not? Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much for what I see there is a couple of questions, one about the sustainability of the regime, and the other about what the fundamental purpose of the regime is, right? And I actually was in a discussion on this very issue yesterday at the Atlantic Council with Anders Osland and others about what is the driving motive here? Is it pillaging? Is it kleptocracy? Or is there something else to what Putin is up to? And I'm very much on, in the book, in reality, on the side of there's something more that they're up to simply than pillaging and stealing. Yes, kleptocracy is part of the system, but is not the entire purpose of the system, like, say, Equatorial Guinea or Zaire under Mobutu. And that, in fact, the most important thing to Putin and the people around him, and I'm going to use this phrase, is to make Russia great again. I actually, you know, end up concluding the book that what they're doing is in some ways counterproductive, but I do think there is a mentality there that is about more than simply pillaging, okay? Not to excuse corruption, not to say it's not happening, it clearly is, but I don't think that's the sole or most important driving force. I think there's a bigger agenda that's behind what Putin does. So the second question is about sustainability of the regime. And it's a parlor question that many of us are asked and none of us have a good answer to, right? Social scientists have a really hard time predicting, especially about the future. But let me say a few things about this. First of all, I think your point about lack of accountability is important. And in a specific way that I think we know about how the regime works now, which is Putin has in some ways constrained the sources of information in a way that he's less likely to hear bad news than maybe he should be. And that people who provide him with information from inside the presidential administration, from inside the security services, know things that he doesn't want to hear, and so therefore don't tell him that. Cross-nationally, regimes that do a poor job of analyzing the situation around them and adapting to it are probably more likely to fail than those that aren't, which is why personalistic dictatorships are more likely to fail than single-party ones or than military ones. That doesn't give us any answer to when or how this might happen, or even if it'll happen at all, because the most sensible prediction is that a regime that is here this year will probably be here next year, right? Most regimes don't collapse from year to year. On the other hand, one in which you have a series of economic problems that don't seem to be being dealt with, including investment, productivity, et cetera, one that seems to have governance problems that it's having trouble coping with at the societal level, and one that has a society that's quite, in some ways, quote unquote, modern, intelligent, educated, urban, and quite diverse, presents a more complicated set of needs and responses than you get from a sort of closed off, personalized political system. So I'm not predicting that the regime will fall or if it'll fall, but I would predict, and you can come back to me about this in 6 years, that this term is going to be the hardest and be more disorderly than any of the previous ones so far.
All right, we'll see you all here in 2024.
Thank you so much for your interesting and thoughtful presentations. To what extent Putin's foreign policy is shaped and forged by the experience of the Second World War, in particular the 900-day siege of Leningrad, at which 2 or 3 million Russians died. Now, at the siege of Leningrad, Putin lost 5 uncles, his father was badly wounded, and barely survived after a heroic evacuation effort. And this siege mentality actually goes back to Tsar Alexander III, who famously said that Russia has only 2 reliable allies it can count on, the army and the navy. And Putin added the Air Force, the third reliable ally. So again, the question is, to what extent foreign policy is shaped by the siege, so-called siege mentality?
Okay. Do you want to get an identification?
No, it's okay.
Okay. So one of the things that's happened under Putin has been a very strong emphasis, especially more recently, on World War II as a unifying event in Russian history. The revolution of 1917 is not a unifying event. The collapse of 1991 is not a unifying event. World War II is an event that all Russians can unify around and support. And there's a new book by Sean Walker of The Guardian called The Long Hangover that talks about this. And one of the questions that comes up in this context is how much of this is manufactured and how much of it is genuine. I think the answer is probably both. I think there's some manufacturing going on, but I think it's also genuine not only for much of Russian society, but also for Putin and the people around him. And you're right, if you look at the 2000 campaign biography that came out with Putin, he talks a lot about his family's experience in the war and the impact that had on him. So I think it feeds into this notion about how Russia needs to be a great power, Russia needs to be unified. World War II demonstrated that when the country was not unified and a great power is when it collapsed and was weak. And so that is used both as a legitimate reason and also a tool of promoting a particular form of rule that I call Putinism.
Okay. Is there anybody not in the front row yet? Yuval.
Okay, this is Yuval.
Thanks very much. Yuval Weber, Daniel Morgan Graduate School and Wilson Center. Sounds like a very interesting book, and pardon me if this is like a sort of a wide-ranging question. So in terms of the code, I'm looking forward to bringing back like Ladies, Alexander, George, even some of the George Kennan stuff. So I'm guessing it probably doesn't replicate the methodology, but brings in the idea there are things that perhaps the leader knows is possible in other people. And what it struck me in your presentation and the descriptions here, particularly talking about how much is Russia, how much is Putinism, is that Putin comes in at a moment and is effectively like a really good sports coach, and that the team is not doing well, but he knows fundamentally what they want to do, what the team wants to do, what they're able to do, and is able to motivate them. And it seems like this particular story of Putinism is that it's very particular to one man in an opportunity at a specific time, and that the sustainability is probably very low, because whenever Putin leaves the stage, whether it's tomorrow or in 6 years or in 12 years, that the next person won't be the guy who follows Yeltsin, and the next person won't be the guy who comes in at a point in which, let's say, confidence, emotions, everything is at its very low. So there is something in terms of this that, as you said, personalistic regimes can't be replicated by other people. So I think that's one thing, that's basically like one point to consider. And really when I was thinking about how to formulate this question, this is the question for you, I guess, is it also speaks to a different debate within sort of Russian leadership studies, which is that of, let's say, of Pipes versus Richard Pipes versus Ned Keenan, in the sense that Pipes views or has depicted Russian leaders as these iron tsars, these autocrats. And Keenan says the leader is the adjudicator in chief. Mm-hmm. So how do you think this book and sort of your view of Putin responds to basically the man who makes decisions, points the fingers, makes things happen, and basically the person who knows how to balance between different groups? Mm-hmm. And how does that sort of help you think about sustainability and going forward?
Sure. Two great questions. So let me take the second one first. I think Putin was so successful, especially early on, because he was a master of the job of adjudicating between different groups and playing them off against each other, making sure all of them were more or less satisfied, keeping everyone sort of on the team. I think there has been kind of a shift over time. So in the 1990s, loyalty to Putin was demonstrated towards Anatoly Sobchak, the mayor of St. Petersburg, towards Yeltsin as president. Once he becomes president, it's loyalty to a team. He's got his team. There are other groups that are competing with his team, and he's trying to strengthen his group against possible alternative rivals. I think that shifted over time, and when he comes back in 2012, he's looking not so much at loyalty to the team that kind of binds him, but loyalty of the team to him as an individual. So in that sense, he's elevating himself to a certain extent above the clans and is no longer simply the arbitrator of them, but is a more czar-like figure, if we can put it in those terms. And that, I think, helps explain Yakunin Ivanov, sorry for the name dropping, the head of the railroads, the former minister of defense and former chief of staff, and bringing in younger people who were his bodyguards, were his adjunct, and who are much better at demonstrating the loyalty to him and not sort of playing with him at an equal level like some of these other people might think they were doing. I don't know if that gets exactly at the Pipes Keenan thing, but I think that's how I see his role in the system. So to a certain extent, he was the Keenan mode early on, but now he's the Pipes mode, I guess is the answer, the short answer to the question. On the second point, how much of this is about one man, one time, what happens after him, this sort of relates to the discussion about exportability, right? How much of this is a question about how any autocrat will try and rule in the modern world today, and how much of it is about a specific personality and the group around him and their mentality. And I argue in the book both that it's specific to Russia and that Russia has, maybe this picks up on a theme of Steve's, a more post-imperial moment now than some of these other countries that are adopting similar styles, because there was only two superpowers and one of them collapsed. And so the feeling of the need to restore that status, the resentment about that loss of status, I think resonates more in Russia, both with the leadership and the population, than it might in other countries that are also promoting post-imperial resentment. So that, I think, makes Russia sort of unique. And I also think, and this is, you know, fundamental to the argument, that there is a core mentality here, and regardless of how much Putin wants to shape who comes after him, and even if it's a member of his team, that eventually is going to fade, right? There are going to be other players who came into this at a different point in history and have different circumstances of their development that is going to shape their mentality and lead it in a different direction. So in that sense, both in terms of its exportability horizontally and then sort of ahead in time, I think there are certain limits. There will be attempts to do both, but it's constrained.
Can I quickly add a point to Brian's? It really has to do with generational change and the difference between ideological regimes like Marxism, Leninism, or this kind of less this ideational but not ideological regime. With ideologies, you can indoctrinate the next generation, right? I mean, in China today or in the Soviet Union for two generations, you were able to actually get young Soviet citizens to take the Soviet example. And we now know from a lot of good research that as late as the Brezhnev period into the Gorbachev era, lots of ordinary Soviet citizens took that stuff sort of seriously, you know. Not necessarily they understood all these, you know, classes on dialectical materialism, but it was the world in which people grew up and it became a kind of norm. Personalistic regimes that just have emotions affect, you know, the sort of more amorphous material, much more difficult to train the next generation. They tried to do textbook revisions to emphasize, you know, patriotism. World War II definitely has come up. But I think one of the struggles is that if you try to make an ideology that could be, you know, taught to the young out of Putinism, you end up with Alexander Dugin, which is not actually Putinism. It's a much more kind of hidebound, organized ideological system. The same is true with people like Dulles, Evola, that Steve Bannon, you know, admires. There is a kind of new right ideology out there, but that's not actually what's going over borders right now. It's much more the emotions and the psychology of resentment than the ideology itself. And that, to me, speaks to a kind of difficulty for recruitment of the next generation. Yeah, you can put some former bodyguards in charge of things, or, you know, get an obscure provincial person to make them your chief of staff. But it's not a wholesale replacement of the old generation with a new generation of people who know what Putinism is. And that, I think, is a sign of weakness.
Really good insight. Let's see, over here.
Yeah, Dan Lieberman, I'm a writer. You termed Putin as anti-American, which sounds irrational and emotional. Wouldn't it be more accurate to say he's against American domination and American hegemony, which sounds more rational and pragmatic? And I think you also said that Putin is really leading Russia to a dead end politically, but he has replaced the governors, who mainly were politically inclined, with young technocrats. And I believe he also ran as an independent, which seemed to show he's trying to make fundamental changes in the political system.
Okay, great. Two questions there. So the first about the anti-Americanism claim, and I know this is a controversial issue. So I think that Putin definitely sees his foreign policy view as being completely rationally grounded on bad things the Americans have done, right? And I would subscribe to a certain set of the list that he would give us, okay? Withdrawal from the ABM treaty, invasion of Iraq, missile defense emplacements, like lots of other lots of things that he object to, I'm happy to sign up for and agree with him on. But I think his emotional and ideational attitude about this goes beyond that to where he's seeing American activity where American activity doesn't exist. And maybe it's because I have a lack of faith in the competence in our government to carry out very elaborate conspiracies that no one can see but the government itself. But I don't believe that the Beslan terrorist incident was something that was in some way enabled by CIA links to North Caucasian terrorists, which Putin has asserted. I don't think the revolution in Ukraine in 2013, 2014 was caused by the Americans, whether it was passing out cookies or anything else that Americans might have done in Kiev. I think that was mainly homegrown. So there's an element of to it, and all you talked about this earlier, that one can explain in terms of sort of realist views of foreign policy and Russian national interests. But I actually think that for Putin, it goes beyond that, and in some ways leads him to make political decisions that are harmful for Russia in the long term. And I would put Crimea on that list, which I think was an emotional reaction to a misreading of what happened in Kiev, rather than a rational defense of actual threats to Russian interests. I would put interference in the US election in that category as well, that he saw the US behind the 2011-2012 protests, that he saw the US behind the Panama Papers revelations about corruption. I don't think the US is behind all those things. He seems to think that they are, and I do think he genuinely believes this, but therefore I think it leads to certain foreign policy mistakes. So I'll half go down the realist road, but I won't go all the way down the realist road. And the part I won't go down is explained, I think, by the code. In terms of changes he's making in terms of young technocrats and that sort of thing, yes, there are personnel turnovers and personnel changes. Some of these people are probably competent. But I think really since 2003, 2004, Vladimir Putin has been inclined to not make the difficult decisions in terms of domestic policy reform, in terms of state administration, in terms of legal reform, in terms of economics that the country needs. And so that's why you have 10 years now of average annual growth being 1%. Right? It's gone up and down, but the average over the last decade has been 1%, as opposed to his first 9 years in which it was 7%. This is why Russia outperforms its peers in terms of corruption, in terms of lack of adherence to the rule of law, and other cross-national indicators of performance. And his first term, in some ways, was his best, and he's had a good run, but I think for Russia as a whole, if we look at political and economic performance, they're doing not as well as they could be if different decisions had been made. Well, you had the oil crisis, but from 2011 to 2014, the world price of oil was over $100 a barrel, the highest it had been in history, and economic growth went from 3.2% to about 1.2% over that four-year period. They had trillions of dollars coming into the system. The returns they got of it in terms of improved governance, I would say, were minimal.
Okay, over here.
Francis Brigham Johnson. I was on Maxwell campus in 1949-1950 when the world was changing and we saw the Russians making their dent, and we, of course, were putting up our dukes. Now time passes and we have all recently had the chance to see these two presidents, one of Russia and one of America, have an interchange with each other. We have many derogatory remarks about what Mr. Trump was attempting to do, but according to Napolitano, who has been a judge and long time on the scene in Washington, Mr. Trump was trying to pull the thinking of Mr. Putin, see what he expects to accomplish for Russia. Mr. Trump could give Mr. Putin a recognition of the respect and the progress that Russia has made. Now, do you think that between the two of them, either or both could have gotten some ideas as to some common objective or goal for each of their countries that they might have acquired out of their interchange?
First of all, it's great to have Maxwell grads here in the audience, so thank you for that. So about the Helsinki summit, I mean, in terms of substance, as far as we can tell, nothing really important and specific was agreed to at the summit on some of the key issues on the agenda, whether it's arms control or Ukraine or Syria or whatever. In terms of optics, certainly my initial reaction, I think most people's initial reaction, was this was a big win for Putin, because you had the spectacle of the American and Russian president in front of the world press, with Trump appearing to take the side of Putin over his own intelligence agencies about what happened with the 2016 electoral interference. With some hindsight, it seems that it went so badly for Trump and so well for Putin that this is actually bad for Putin. He did too well. And that now the degree of suspicion in the US about the Trump-Putin relationship is even higher, even more discussions in Congress about ways of trying to hem in the Russians and sanction the Russians. And the things that they apparently talked about in secret are even more non-starters than they were before they had the conversation. So in some sense, after a couple of weeks' reflection, I see it as kind of a bad outcome for both sides, which is probably why they're putting off another meeting. And I've never worked in the US government or any other government, but what I've learned from the outside about summits is you have to have an agenda and you have to have some communication in advance and some deliverables that you're trying to achieve. And if you just go in open-handed, then nothing comes out and then it all dissolves to the optics. And I think the optics here were not good.
So. We'll do it again with Iran, maybe. in the back there.
My name is Andrei Larionov from Kate Institute. Could I have a couple of observations and one question? So one, when you're talking about this Crimea annexation and the emotional reaction of Mr. Putin, which annexation of Crimea happened to be the result of that, just as a matter of fact, the beginning of the planning of long-term strategy of annexation of Crimea can be detected in summer of year 2003 of government long-term strategy of annexation of Crimea, studied in at least, maybe earlier, but it is, can be detected in summer of year 2003. Second, you have very important graph, table 4, I believe, 4.1, whether you're using GDP numbers in purchasing power parity in year 2011 prices. Probably it's from IMF or World Bank. It's okay to use for year 2011 or for this period of high oil prices. It is quite misleading to use it for a longer period of time, because for a period of early 90s, it creates absolutely wrong impression about the relation between Russia, Soviet Union, Eastern European countries. It's kind of wrong relation. It's a kind of technical economic issue. If you'd like, we can discuss it after that, but it's not correct to use it for a longer period of time. It's okay for this period of high prices, oil prices that you were talking about. And the question is, just coming to discussion about the type of regime. What is, from your analysis, this regime is? Personal, one party, meritocracy, or anything else?
Okay. Great. Two comments on the comments and then an answer to the question. So I hesitate to disagree with you, since you actually were working for the Russian government in 2003 and I was not, but I guess I would say that having plans for a military operation in Crimea is different than having a plan to annex Crimea. And I am not surprised that there were plans. I don't see this what happened in 2014 as the playing out of a long-term strategy. And if we consider the counterfactual in which Euromaidan doesn't happen, it's hard for me to imagine that in February 2014 that Russia would annex Crimea. So I think it has to be a response to that. Yes, there may have been plans. The point I was trying to make with the GDP growth graph, and again, you're an economist and I'm not, so to a certain extent I defer to you, but I would also say the point I'm trying to make there is that Russia was a pretty typical, maybe I'm wrong here, post-communist country in that it had a big depression in the early 1990s, some bigger, some lower, and it had a rebound in the early 2000s that also was cross-regional. So we shouldn't think either that Yeltsin was particularly bad for the economy or that Putin was particularly good for the economy, because there were larger regional forces going on that drove some of the performance there. That's the point I'm trying to make with that graph, and we can discuss whether or not that's accurate or not. On the final question, the answer is simple. It's a personalistic regime. It's not a one-party state. It is not a militocracy. It's a personalistic regime.
Okay. Here. Oh, sorry, it was this gentleman up here.
Thank you. George Folsom. You've touched on this a bit already, but Putin is not infallible. Let's say he dies tonight. Mm-hmm. What happens to Russia? Mm-hmm.
That's a great question. And it's actually the question with which I begin and end the book, because there's this famous quote by the person who's now the Speaker of the Duma and used to work in the presidential administration in the Kremlin, in which he says, there is Putin, there is Russia. There is no Putin, there is no Russia. This political commentator, very sort of strident patriot, Sergei Markov, was asked about that at the time. And I would think, as a Russian patriot, that you would find that insulting, the notion that the fate of the country depends on one person. But Markov's response is, yes, that's right, because in Russia we have a very strong president, but very weak institutions. I don't see that as a positive state of affairs, in which the personality in the individual is stronger than the institution. And so that's where I close and open the book. And I think you're right to raise that question, because although there is a constitutionally defined process for what happens if for some reason Putin is not with us tomorrow, that would be Prime Minister Medvedev would become president, most people who follow Russia assume that that would not hold. You know, even if it took place in the short term, that all the clans would start fighting for each other and some extra institutional outcome would be realized. And if that's the case, that means that Putin has built a system that is actually quite fragile if it depends so much on the health of one individual.
Okay, further questions? Well, let's get you, since we almost got you last time.
Thank you. I'm Tom Wunder from Indiana University. And my question has to do with this shift in modes that you discussed in response to Yuval's question about a shift from being more of a first among equals or an adjudicator to more of a czar-like figure. And the question I have is, why do you think that's occurred in light of the motivations that you laid out in the presentation and in the book, especially since a lot of the shift has come at the expense of hollowing out of state institutions and actually making a lot of in favor of personalistic rule, which seems to be, to me, to be at odds with the sort of idea of Putin as a statist, which I agree with, but these seem to be contradictory motions. So, mm-hmm. Thank you.
That's a really interesting way of putting it, and I confess I hadn't thought about it quite in that way before, right? How do you have someone who's so fundamentally a statist at heart who seems to be hollowing out the set of state institutions, right? And I think it goes back to this idea of what it means to be a statist for Putin, which doesn't mean building institutions that work on their own. It means having a system in which loyalty is owed to the state, both on the part of people who work for the state and people in society outside the state. So it's not, in some sense, a social contract that we might think of in the democratic tradition. It's much more a system of loyalty to the state. And so he believes in the importance of the state and the primacy of the state, and I think the people around him do, and many Russians do. He actually at one point claimed it was genetic, this sort of statism. He said it's a genetic feature of Russia, which I don't believe, and I'd hate to see the biologist trying to find that gene. But you know, he has this notion, but he also has this feeling of vulnerability about the system. And one of my favorite Putin quotes, and favorite by which I mean I think the most revealing, was in 2007, he said, "We went through a period of very deep crisis after the Soviet collapse in the 1990s, and so we were forced to do a lot in the mode of a manual regime, in terms of manual steering. And it's going to take some time to develop institutions that actually work and regulate on their own." And a reporter followed up and said, "Well, how long will that take?" And he said 15 or 20 years, which would put us at 2022 to 2027. So he's still very much in the manual regime mode. He doesn't believe institutions will function on their own. And he also, I don't think, believes that the system is that strong without his need to personally intervene in a lot of the processes going on, which I think further hollows out these institutions. So it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. His need for sort of control and order and feeling of vulnerability means he's not building the state institutions that, in theory, he claims he wants to build.
Okay. Over here.
Yeah, I'm Larry. I'm with the Orthodox Church. I just wanted to bring up quickly in relation to what he said. I don't want to sound like an apologist for this country like Mr. Trump, but isn't there some bit of truth that Putin's anti-Americanism was fueled by anti-Russian sentiment in this country? Because, I mean, if you go back in history, even in the early 90s, at the beginning of the Yeltsin era, I remember some odd anti-Russian statements being floated around. Like Yeltsin was doing a hoax on this country to make it look like he was a democratic guy because he planned to invade us. And, I mean, our country, look at our military-industrial complex, which President Eisenhower warned us about. They have a history of finding enemies, trying to retain enemies, and even taking allies and trying to turn them into enemies. And I mean, if you just look back a few years ago at the Boston Marathon bombing, there was attempts to blame Russia for that, even though the Russian government told us everything about those two brothers we needed to know, and we chose to ignore. But I mean, our military-industrial complex tried to put a blame on Russia after that, so.
Okay, thanks. This is getting back to a point we discussed again, but maybe I'll try and come at it in a slightly different way. So from the point of view of many Russian elites, not talking about society, which we can talk about as well, but many Russian elites, the period of the 1990s was one in which they were forced to endure multiple humiliations by Western actors, especially the United States, in terms of the way it gave advice, the way it refused to listen to legitimate Russian concerns about a host of issues, and so on and so forth. And they feel that continued into the 2000s, right? I would not say that all of those feelings were misguided. I think there was a certain element of that to US policy after the end of the Cold War, and even early documents that came out of the George H.W. Bush administration going back to 1991 had very sort of grand ideas about how to build and sustain American unipolar domination of the international system. So yes, that is true. And so I guess just go back to the point I made earlier that one can understand these feelings of resentment in feeling that the US has not treated Russia fairly without going to the point of claiming that the United States is trying to break up Russia and steal all of its oil and gas, which I don't think the US is trying to do, although oil and gas companies are willing to make deals to discuss those issues. But there isn't this sort of grand conspiracy organized by Washington to make and keep Russia weak. And I don't think, for example, that the economic advice that was given by the United States in the 1990s was A, designed to weaken Russia, and B, was actually really that bad given what people knew at the time. I think they were doing the best in uncertain circumstances to help Russia, and the primary decisions, both positive and negative, were made in Moscow and not made in Washington. So I don't think we should overstate American influence on Russian outcomes, although I think we should try and be sympathetic in the sense of understanding how things often looked to Russian citizens and Russian elites.
Okay. We are running up against our time constraints, so I'm going to take three questions at once, and then we'll let Brian wrap up. So let's do one, two, and then three.
Thank you. Voice of America, Russian Service. It's interesting you used the word Putinism, the word which politologist Gleb Pavlovsky is using in his interviews for 2 years to 3 years. And when he uses it, he's saying that Putin is not anymore in that control of the system. And that's why he kind of invented this Putinism thing that Pavlovsky, that's saying that the whole system, Putinism, will stay, even Putin will go, will leave tomorrow. To what extent, and my question to you and to Olga, Putin is still in control? Because Pavlovsky, in his interviews with me in particular, saying that Putin is now kind of left for only international role to play with all these big games and all the wealth and all real politics, domestic politics, are controlled by very different people, very different groups, and so on. So will this stay if he will go? And to what extent he's in control of the system?
Okay. Over here. Just pass it down.
Herb Rose. I recently heard or read a figure about Putin's self-worth, and I was surprised. I don't know how the number was arrived at. I don't think Putin revealed his tax returns any more than Trump has. But I also wonder how much of his self-worth was determined by manipulating the system for his own interests as opposed to the interests of Russia.
Okay, and then one more question in the back over here.
I'm Kevin Reel. I want you to estimate, how would the person on the street in Russia receive the assertions in your book? Not the elites, but the person on the street. Would they be offended by it? Would they be resigned to it? Would they be proud of it? How would they see this idea that there is a code that rules them?
Okay. Why don't we take the floor? Yeah, let's, Kathy, just really quickly.
I'll be short, Kathy Cosman. Don't you think then corruption is what is the lubricant for the system? I mean, I'm surprised that corruption is not part of your code. Thank you.
Okay, so how much is Putin actually in charge? How much is Putin worth? What do ordinary Russians think about this? And what about corruption?
Excellent.
Go.
Okay, all right. Let's take two and four together, because they're both in various ways about corruption, right? How much money is Vladimir Putin worth? And why is corruption not part of the code? Part of the reason corruption is not part of the code is that what I'm trying to do with this notion of the code or mentality is isolate the non kind of instrumental rational pursuit of power and wealth that everyone else talks about, right? So that's the standard way that most social scientists try and analyze what's going on, is to look at, you know, what's the personal benefit for this person, whether it's power or wealth or whatever their goals are. And I'm trying to say that if we think about what makes humans tick, there's a lot more to their decision making than just short-term calculations of interest. And the code is trying to get at some of those other elements. So, Kathy, you're shaking your head. We're going to have to talk about this afterwards, okay? So, yes, there's corruption in the system. Yes, there's obviously corruption in Russian society as a whole, and it's an important part of how the system works. But I don't see it, again, I said this earlier, as the main driver of the system. I think there are larger goals at stake. Now, this brings us to the question of how much Putin is individually worth. I was just at an event yesterday where Anders Osland made an estimation that was over $100 billion. I have no idea what the answer to that question is, okay? Numbers are thrown around, 20 billion, 100 billion, 200 billion. To me, that's all funny money, right? I mean, and it's hard to know specifically about those things. Now, we can point to certain interviews by people who used to be in the system. We can point to certain amounts of money held by people close to Putin who have no other explanation for where that money came from, other than through these connections, childhood friends, you know, cousins, that sort of thing. And we can account for some of that money, but I honestly don't know the answer to that question. And I'm gonna go whole hog and put myself in Putin's head again, because that's part of what the book tries to do. And I think to the extent that he's making money out of this enterprise, this is deserved rewards for service to the nation. Right? If Potanin has all this money, if Deripaska has all these money, these apartments and villas and yachts, you know, I'm doing more for the nation than any of them. I deserve some of the benefits of this as well. I actually don't know. I'm just speculating here. But I would think that might be one way he justifies this to himself, as well as the need to provide for his family, who obviously will be provided for, assuming those resources pass on. So the question about the system and how much Putin is in charge, it does seem to be clear to most analysts, and I think this is correct, that Putin is kind of bored with domestic political and economic issues and much more enjoys the foreign policy aspect of the job, you know, the Russian security foreign policy issues. And to that extent, he's leaving questions about social and political issues to a different set of actors to fight it out, although he always has the possibility as arbiter of the system to step in and say, this is the way it's going to be. So it was interesting the way he almost pretended he knew nothing about the pension reform when he was asked about it, as if this was something that was happening without, you know, his ultimate say in what happens with pension rates. But I think part of it is that he really doesn't know what to do. I think he has a certain set of advisors, you know, the Kudrins of the world, who are coming to him and saying, look, we need to strengthen this set of institutions. We need to make these sets of decisions. Those sets of decisions are ones that he's not really willing to take because he fears the consequences of them, because the quote unquote institutional reforms that these people are suggesting ultimately means building a different political system. And he doesn't want to build a different political system. He likes the political system he has. So I think there has been a bit of a divorce from some of these issues, but that doesn't mean he's not still in charge. He's still the ultimate decision maker. And then the final question, how the person on the street would react to this book. In Russia, obviously. I actually would be curious what the other panelists think about this. I tried to, also in a Weberian sense, to try and understand how the world seems from that person's point of view. But at the end, I also end up coming to fairly critical conclusions about what the system has become and what that means for Russia's future. So I'd like to think I was fair to him, but although I doubt if that's how he would see it, right? What the person on the street thinks, I think the person on the street would probably not like an American professor telling him what Putin is doing wrong, quite honestly, right? You know, he's our guy, you know, he's doing the best he can. There are obviously some people who don't like him, but I think the opinion polls are more or less accurate that he has this status of being co-equal with Russia, and if you're criticizing him, you're criticizing Russia. So American professor guy is criticizing him, that means he's criticizing Russia. So I'm not expecting a Russian edition to come out anytime soon, if that's the question.
At least not in Russia. okay, it is 3:30. I want to give our two panelists a real quick chance to say a couple of last words, so maybe 30 seconds each.
So I agree with Brian, just to answer the questions addressed to me, I agree with Brian on the question of control. I think there's sometimes, because there is this vision of Putin as a grand puppet master, there's this belief that in control means controlling everything right. all the time. No, he does not control everything all the time. Is he the decider in Russia in up to, down to very, very low levels if those level issues come to him? Absolutely. Do people worry about what Vladimir will think? Constantly. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, he is very much in control. Does he run everything? Is he behind everything? Absolutely not. And on that theme, and kind of in defense of neorealism or in a different way of looking at it, I think weakness and vulnerability tend to make you think that the other guy is hyper-competent. Mm-hmm. And tend to make you think that they're in charge of everything. And I attribute Russian paranoia about the United States to that, and I attribute American paranoia about Russia, which has emerged more recently, yeah. to that as well, where we've gone from these myths of tremendous American competence, that the Americans are behind all the things and all the conspiracy theories, to these myths that the Russians are behind all the things and all the conspiracy theories and capable of doing everything amazing. I'd also say, I think the average Russian, not that I talk to an awful lot of average Russians, I talk to an awful lot of overeducated Russians, but my guess is, presented the way this is presented, they might not like it, but presented a little bit differently, mm-hmm. they might agree with it. And it's, so if you talk about, you know, we think that Russia is driven by the idea that it should be a great power and a strong state, that it's not like the West, it's not like America is its own thing, that it is rooted in conservative views of social ties, that we believe in law and order, that we believe in sticking together and not about a lot of individuals doing what they want, that we're loyal to one another and, by gosh, a man's a man, and that we've been hurt over the years because we stand up for all these things. I think your average Putin voter mm-hmm. is going to say, yeah, that makes sense.
I'll agree completely with what Olya just said. I think the person on the street, if this is a literate person who cares about reading political science analyses, it's already a sort of a smaller sample size. But that group that's literate and, you know, which is fairly large in Russia, they won't find it that offensive, and there's a few reasons. You know, one is this whole book and this amazing presentation really shows the importance of what we used to call area studies. Brian's fluent in Russian. He's been studying it for 20 plus years, 30 maybe now. We're getting older. Some of us hung in there, you know, after the Soviet Union collapsed. And for what it's worth, I think we kind of got something out of that because, you know, the nuances are correct. So just something as simple as saying this is about государственность or loyalty to the state, statism, rather than, for example, nationalism, you know, kind of Russian, Ruski nationalism, is a nuance that matters a lot in Russian discourse. And if you present it the way Brian did, taking into account the internal debates and the difference of those words, a lot of Russians say, well, thank you for noticing, because you know what we hear in the US is people saying it's all Russian nationalism, it's Russian mafia, that's another touch word. If you say the Russian mafia, you lose everybody, because you know, you're talking to an educated population of 140 million people, as I said before. And if you say it's all the Russian mafia, people get offended, not surprisingly. So I think the book, you know, does, by taking an empathetic approach, not an approach that says Putin is great, but one that understands he's a human being with a point of view, it allows us to understand, by the way, also the support for Putin in the society on those exact points you mentioned. A lot of people resent US neglect from their point of view of Russian interests after the end of the Cold War. Liberals who don't like Putin in any other way, some of my close friends, will tell you, yeah, you know, I don't really love what he does, I don't like him personally, but you got to admit it was kind of cool we took Crimea. And they say that because it feels to them like a moment where they stood up and did something that no Americans thought they could do, and everyone paid attention again. Mm-hmm. So I don't think the book is really going to, I don't know if it's translated into Russian soon, that's a different issue.
All right, well, thank you, both of you, and thanks to Brian. Let's give them all a round of applause.